This episode of Earl Grey is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org.
Hi, this is Marina Sirtis, Deanna Troi from Star Trek The Next Generation. You're listening to Trek FM.
Earl Grey hot.
Hello and welcome to another cup of Earl Grey, Trek FM's dedicated podcast to the next generation. I'm your host, Joe Keegan. Justin's away again this week, 2 weeks in a row. So obviously my favourite other podcasting host is with me today. And that is Amy Nelson. Amy, how are you today?
I am doing great. I am here recording from Salt Lake City.
Which isn't said in an offensive way. It's said in the way that they say it in the Book of Mormon, the musical, written yes. by the guys who wrote South Park, which is probably why it sounds offensive. In case you didn't know.
Yes.
So, Amy, quiz time.
Uh-oh.
Amy, are you ready for
this? Yes. Okay, bring it.
Okay, so what is the motto of Utah? Because that is where you are just now.
Oh, I know this. I know a lot about my home state. Okay, the motto is tell me how many words is it, will you please?
One. Well, based on Wikipedia, that's my only source. So if it's wrong, it's not
industry.
Yes. Well done.
Yes.
1 point. Ding, ding, ding.
Ding, ding.
Second question.
Yes.
What is the official nickname of Utah?
Like, the official nickname?
What do you call them now? Like you get the Sunshine State, which is Florida.
The Beehive State.
Correct.
The Beehive State.
Ding, ding, ding. That's when you get a point. You get ding, ding, ding. I'm waiting for you to get a wrong one because then I have to make up a sound effect for an incorrect answer. What is the name of the anthem, the state anthem of Utah?
Utah, we love thee. Yeah, huh? That's our state song.
It's Utah, this is the place, according to Wikipedia.
It's wrong.
Well, you can go and edit Wikipedia.
I will have to.
Please do. Excellent. You got, according to my scoring technique, 2 out of 3. Well done. You win a prize, which is my love forever.
Oh.
Anyways, so, Amy, where is Justin?
Well, he's enjoying his holiday with his love, Rosie, and took some time off. You know, I took 2 weeks off and you took some time off. That's, you know.
Yeah, I took time off to go to a Star Trek convention, though. That's like taking time off work to go to work.
It's still really. Family.
True.
It's still family.
Same in the same family. Okay, cool.
Yes.
So we have some Babel Conference feedback. And we have Babel Conference feedback from Earl Grey, episode 303, which was the Science and TNG Part 5. Amy, would you like to give us some feedback, please?
Yes, so Drew Barker writes, I really enjoyed this episode and I'm glad you're going to carry on with at least another science in Star Trek 1. So yes, we have the movies to go over. So Drew, we are going to have more science in TNG.
We have the movies and also we might have a super extra special guest on who's like super famous. Not for being in Star Trek, but for being a proper scientist. So they may be joining us sometime in the future.
Yes.
Patrick Carlin says, hashtag still listening, I'd go to one where we got at least two or three more seasons of Enterprise. And this was in response to the question, Justin's question, where to what universe would you go to, given an infinite number of universes? And Patrick would go to the one with two or three more seasons of Enterprise. And I think given the trash fire, which was Enterprise's season finale, not my words, I found these online, I think they deserve another couple of seasons. I would like to have seen what they did in seasons 6 and 7. Did they get 5?
Yeah. No, they only got 4.
Oh, they got 4, so it's season 5 and 6.
Cool. Yes.
Amy.
Well, we have Kimberly Lawler, and she writes, "This was a fun episode. What gets me about the multiple universes thing is the idea that it's everything that has an alternate outcome, not even just minor decisions of human beings, but everything. It's impossible to get your head around. Like the size of the universe in general is too big even to comprehend. I do love parallels, though. I like the variety of topics on Earl Grey and also hearing listener feedback. I'm not sure I'd take that one single comment to heart. It's always good to consider feedback, of course, but consider too whether it's an outlier or not. The format you have works very well with you guys, and this is my favorite podcast." Well, thank you, Kimberly. Parallels is a wonderful and wonderful episode, and yeah, it's mind-boggling thinking about every decision or what decisions is going to create this alternate timeline, but it's great.
Yeah, you know, given I consider myself quite a smart, intelligent person, and I've, in my headcanons, understood the nature of the universe and its magnitude to a point that I'm kind of happy with. I can say, yeah, I understand it, and it sits quite well with me. However, then I actually think about the nature of the universe and the possibility of every decision or every option that's available to every quantum-sized particle gives rise to an infinite number of other realities and other infinite universes. And I'm thinking, yeah, I don't really understand this much. I don't really know what it's talking about in the slightest. So quite happy with my little existence as it is, and the fact that I don't understand anything really. So it's all good. We also have an iTunes review, which is one of the reasons why I love Canada in this case. So Larion via Apple Podcasts on December 18th, 2019, gave us a 5-star review entitled "Fun and, well, More Fun." "Wow. This podcast is amazing. These podcasters always find different, interesting ways to approach the Next Generation series. They love talking about Star Trek and its shows. The hosts, Justin, Amy and Joe, are very dedicated and always deliver quality discussions and exchanges. They regularly have guests coming to podcast with them. The knowledge of TNG and Star Trek in general is there. They know their stuff and they make great connections between Star Trek and their lives, or our lives on this small planet. But honestly, I must convince that I only listen to Earl Grey because Joe is there." And that is the end of the comment.
Oh, I don't think so. Keep on going, really? Joe.
Okay. And the comment continues, "And the only reason for me to enjoy these episodes is that Amy is hosting."
Well, not there we go.
Well, true. Yeah, no, I had to squeeze you in there somehow. "Not forgetting that my only motivation to listen diligently to Earl Grey is that Justin is present. Smiley winky face. Diftor he smoozma" is how the comment ends. Which, for those that don't know, is "Live long and prosper" in Vulcan.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you, Larion.
I think they said that in the motion picture. Now, the scary Vulcan woman at the beginning, she's talking to Spock and Vulcan. I'm sure I heard a smoozma somewhere. I was like, oh, I recognise that. Must be Live Long and Prosper. Then I Googled it and it was. So, Larion, thank you so much for that email. It kind of warmed my cold, dead heart. I know I've said that before, but I'm saying it again. And happy holidays to you. I hope you live forever.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's always so wonderful getting these iTunes reviews, and it's just so nice knowing that we have, you know, at least one listener every now and then. So, yeah.
we have a super very awesome special guest today in the form of Duncan Barrett, who is the host of Trek FM's Primitive Culture podcast. Duncan, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, no, I'm awesome. I'm good. Happy holidays or Merry Christmas or whatever your culture says.
Right back at you.
Thank you.
I hope you've got a quiz for me, by the way.
I don't. No, I just knew.
There you go.
Let's have a quiz.
So you spent the day Googling Salt Lake City, or Utah.
I did. Okay. But so, in which shire are you, Duncan, at the moment of England?
Sussex.
Sussex. Okay, let's have a Sussex quiz.
I will not know the answer to that. We literally moved house about 3 weeks ago. So, you know,
3 weeks.
This will just be embarrassing.
3 weeks.
Oh, you moved?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
We just moved.
Well, I hope there's still a guest room for me.
Just about. There's a sofa bed, I'm afraid. Yeah, we moved. We ended up, it's a very long story that I won't bore your listeners with, but we were trying to buy somewhere and it all fell through. So we've ended up renting a tiny little cottage in this town, Lewis, that we moved to. So, you know, if you find yourself over here, we can put you up, but it might be a bit more cramped than it was the last time.
Oh, wow.
Although hopefully we might have moved by then. I don't know when you're planning your next trip. But you'd be very welcome. It's very lovely down here. We're right by the South Downs, about 20 minutes from Brighton. Really beautiful. Lovely scenery.
Let's not visit at the same time, Amy, then.
Unless you don't mind sharing a sofa bed, you know.
Well, I can do that. Okay, this is quiz time for Duncan.
Keep things close on Earl Grey. Right, okay. Yeah, this will be embarrassing.
Okay. On which coast of England is Sussex?
The South Coast.
That's correct. 1 point. Ding, ding, ding.
Okay. Thank you. That would be kind of bad if I hadn't worked that one out.
As of 2011, to the nearest 500 square miles, what was the area of Sussex?
Oh, my God.
That one's tough.
No idea. To the nearest 500 square miles. This requires maths as well. So let me think. I mean, I would have thought 500. Is it more than that?
How many?
To the nearest 500.
Yeah.
I'm going with 500, which would be... No, hang on. Yeah. Yeah, because that's a lot. That's like 50 miles by 10. No, maybe... Okay, no, I'll go with 2,500.
Oh, close, but...
No.
It's the closest would be 1,500, because it is 1,460.78 square miles.
There you go. You see, I have to say, the reason my first guess was way out, I apologise for Amy, it was just my maths. I was struggling to work out how to do square miles. So at least I worked that bit out. Yeah, but okay, fair enough. Smaller than I thought then.
Okay. And, okay, let's see. Let's another question. Oh, where is the kind of local government headquarters of Sussex? That's possibly two correct answers for this.
Well, that is a good question. I mean, I would have thought, because I know that Lewis, which is the town that I'm living in, used to be the headquarters, like back, because I was doing some research for a book into records in the 1950s, and then they were all stored then. But I imagine they've all moved either to Eastbourne or Brighton. Probably Brighton.
Interesting. Well, Wikipedia gives the headquarters as either Chichester or Lewis.
Okay.
So you can have the point because you did
say
Lewis.
So I get half a point, maybe?
Yes. No, you get a full point.
Definitely used to be Lewis, but I don't know if that's the case anymore.
I'm just, my researchers, Wikipedia, say Chichester or Lewis. So. Mm-hmm. And for a bonus point, what is the motto?
Sussex.
Yeah, motto of Sussex. I've no idea. And it's an unofficial...
with Morris dancing, I don't know.
No, it's We Won't Be Druv.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I have heard that one. I didn't know that was the motto of Sussex. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It means,
there you go.
For Amy...
Thank you. I'm like, what are these words you're speaking?
Yeah. It means...
We won't be driven away. Is that what it means?
We will not be driven.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Okay.
We'll That's stick to our...
All right.
Traditional ways. They're quite big into sort of traditional pastimes here. I mean, there's a big you know, even just a couple of days ago, big controversy about the Amy, I don't know if you're familiar with the Boxing Day hunt is a big thing that people still do in England, despite the fact that it's been illegal for about, getting on for 20 years. And in Lewis, actually, I find this surprising because I certainly haven't met anyone in Lewis who would be in favour of fox hunting. But, you know, obviously there are some. And they meet outside one of the pubs in town. I think it's almost deliberately to kind of stir up trouble with the people who, you know, are opposed to it. And I think that would be, they would see that as one of these things where it's, you know, this is our tradition and damn it all. And again, with the bonfire, with this big bonfire here every, you know, on November the 5th, and some of the kind of traditions to do with the bonfire have been quite controversial in recent years. I know this because although we've just moved down here, we actually were staying here a couple of years ago when all of this was kicking off. And so there's always a kind of battle between the kind of more right on sort of politically correct people who are trying to change these quite sort of backward traditions in a way, and the kind of Sussex traditionalists who won't be druv, which essentially means, you know, we're going to carry on doing these things, however offensive they might be. So it's interesting. I think there's definitely that kind of tension. And a lot of it is to do with the, you know, the DFLs, the down from Londoners, the people like me who are kind of seen as coming in and imposing their
interlopers, you
know, cosmopolitan,
your liberal ways,
their kind of cosmopolitan liberal values. Yeah.
Wow. You can always move back to London if it gets too much, if they chase you out of town with,
well, there you go,
torches and pitchforks.
Yeah. Who knows? Not impossible around these parts. Yeah.
True, true. Okay. So, I will admit that the idea of this topic kind of makes me a little bit nervous because it's like way outside my kind of knowledge base, I suppose. I have spent quite a lot of time researching it. And the topic is high culture and TNG, all the things that never entered my radar when I was growing up. And I feel quite enlightened after researching it. So, Duncan, tell me, why did you want to come on and talk about high culture? Are you highly cultured?
I don't know whether I'm highly cultured. I suppose it was partly because I guess I was kind of thinking, what's a good bridge between Earl Grey and the podcast that I do on Trek FM, Primitive Culture? And Primitive Culture is, as one guest who I had on the show a year or so ago described it to me, he said after the interview, he said, God, that was like being, he didn't say God, he was a priest, he probably said something else. He said, gosh, that was like being on Radio 4. Because I think we do tend to go for these slightly heavy, serious cultural topics, because that's kind of what we do. You know, we look at cultural influences on Star Trek, whether that's the Epic of Gilgamesh or Shakespeare or historical influences or whatever. And it just kind of struck me that of all the Star Trek series, Next Gen, which for me was certainly my kind of sort of gateway drug to the rest of Star Trek anyway, is the one that really brought this kind of high culture into the ship itself. You know, whether you have Picard with his Shakespeare, whether you have the classical music concerts in Ten Forward, whether you have the life drawing classes, you know, this kind of sense that everyone, one way or another, the ship is kind of involved in these sort of lofty cultural pursuits, and that the arts and kind of traditional kind of the classics, in a sense, are going to be a route to that kind of exploration of humanity and finding out the best about humanity and so on. And I think it's interesting. I mean, when you say, you know, this topic seems intimidating or whatever, I mean, I think one of the things that Next Gen did that a lot of people would talk about, and, you know, I could talk about myself, but, you know, many fans will say, that show made me go and read Shakespeare. That show made me get interested. I don't know if anyone says it made them get interested in classical music. Maybe it did. Maybe it made it kind of, I took up the trombone in school. I'm sure that was, you know, subliminally influenced by Riker. Whether we call that high culture or not, I mean, the kind of jazz music and so on. But I mean, I think it's a show that absolutely, as despite being science fiction and set in space and about the future and all this, all these kind of trappings, that wears its kind of cultural, where's its kind of influences, not so much its influences on the story, but this kind of this sense of humanity in the future as being tied to their past, as being as finding something of value in the kind of canon, for want of a better word, or of sort of human culture. I mean, largely Western culture, but you know, at least in theory, this kind of global human and even federation culture, and that sort of being important to them. So I think NextGen kind of stakes some sort of claim to that. It's sort of saying something about this utopian idea of humanity in the future is very much one where we haven't forgot our past, where the past is something that we kind of carry with us. And I suppose Picard is the kind of real emblem of that. I mean, literally, you know, having a copy of Shakespeare open in his ready room for consultation at all times.
Do you think they did that because he was a Shakespearean actor? And that was his...
I think they must have done. Yeah. That's got to be part of it. I mean, famously, I don't know if you've heard this story about that, when the casting was announced for Next Gen, in the, I think, the Los Angeles Times, he was described as unknown British Shakespearean actor Patrick Stewart. And Brent Spiner apparently got this printed out in big letters and stuck on Patrick Stewart's dressing room door. So that was kind of how he was known, unknown British Shakespearean actor. So I'm sure that was a part of it. And of course, the casting process for Picard, they'd found him in a Shakespeare workshop that he was teaching. So yes, I guess Patrick Stewart was very much identified with Shakespeare and with the kind of classical theatre. And later, of course, with A Christmas Carol, which is another thing that kind of works its way into Next Gen with the episode's Tapestry. And then again, in All Good Things, particularly All Good Things, very heavily influenced by A Christmas Carol, which Patrick Stewart was performing. He's been performing again this week, I think, at the age of 79 or whatever he is. He just revived the show, you know, many years on. So again, the sense, I suppose, that the actor brings those things to the character. I guess Gates McFadden, they knew she was a choreographer, so they got her to do a bit of dancing. And she directs plays as well, and they got her to do a bit of directing plays. I think there is often an element of that. Presumably Jonathan Frakes had been playing the trombone for a while, and they decided to kind of bring that in. So I think a lot of this, it is Picard that sort of sets the tone for this kind of... the sort of culture that we see on the Enterprise in the Next Generation. And I suppose it is Patrick Stewart who kind of influences Picard in some ways. Those things kind of, you know, weave back and forth into each other.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that Jonathan Frakes played the trombone. And every time I see him play the trombone...
I might be wrong, but if he...
in an episode, I'm like, is he actually playing it, or is it dubbed over? So... it's good to know that you actually...
because Brent Spiner is certainly not playing the violin. I assume that Colm Meaney is not playing the cello, though I could be wrong. Maybe he's actually a, you know, demon cellist. But Frakes, I think, is playing the trombone. I'd be interested. Someone can correct me. If not, I'd be interested to know. But
it's interesting that I play the piano. So anytime I see somebody on TV or in movies play the piano, I find it really amusing because it's so obvious when they're not. Like Odo... and Deep Space Nine, when he's playing the piano, and his hands are kind of roughly moving in the right direction, but he's like, he's just doing that kind of thing. Sorry, listeners, you couldn't actually see what I was doing.
And Picard with the flute, actually, there's a scene where if you watch it, bearing in mind that it's not his hands playing the flute, it's very obvious that he's just like kind of standing there with his, or sitting there with his hands behind his back, and someone else's hands are kind of reaching up and playing the notes on the flute while he blows into it. Oh, so, yeah. You know.
Oh, come on. It's essentially a penny whistle, isn't it? It's not that hard to. You could have done a wee Frere Jacques or something on it, surely.
I know, you know. I mean, think of the research he did for other episodes. I mean, he went and watched, you know, hours of hideous videos from Amnesty International for Chain of Command. You know, you'd think he could have learned to play the penny whistle.
Exactly, but yeah.
There you go. Not in his contract.
Clearly. Maybe he didn't have YouTube around at the time to for tutorials, penny whistle tutorials.
Yeah.
Amy, tell me, when you were watching The Next Generation originally, was Shakespeare on your radar as like an American, kind of, let's call you a teenager at the time?
Yeah, no, it wasn't. And when talking about Shakespeare and like with my friends at school, my next door teacher neighbor, she's an English teacher. And I was like, oh my gosh, I need to talk to her because there's a lot of Shakespeare going on. And I don't really know all the stories that come up. And so I wanted to, you know, talk to her, but then she moved schools and I've just been out of touch with her. But no, there really is so much in doing the research. I'm really quite surprised, and I need to study a little bit more Shakespeare. I mean, everyone learns Hamlet in high school. So when I hear, you know, Picard speaking Hamlet, I'm like, oh, I know that. What a piece of work is man. I know that one because I had to memorize that soliloquy, but the others is just completely lost.
But Amy, did you memorize it better than Picard? Because that speech, Picard gets it wrong in the episode, which is a bizarre, I think. I don't know how that happens. And I don't know how Patrick Stewart, who I don't know whether he played Hamlet, but he must have been in productions of Hamlet and must have been, and he was teaching the Shakespeare workshop. I assume it was in the script and someone told him to do it, or maybe it was just a bad take or something. But anyway, you know, because the line is, what a piece of work is a man, not man. So it's very strange, I think, that we have Picard actually misquoting Shakespeare. Unless, of course, the universe that Star Trek takes place in, Shakespeare wrote something slightly different. And there are different versions of Hamlet. I mean, there are famously bad quartos and good quartos and so on. There are different readings of different lines. But as far as I know, that is not one of them. I mean, again, I'm not a Shakespeare scholar. I may be wrong. Maybe in some bad quarter that is there. But, it's, you know, generally speaking, that line is given, what a piece of work is a man, not man. And I think this may be an example of the writers changing it to... It slightly underscores the point that Picard is making better in removing that A. But at the same time, it is odd because, for anyone who's really familiar with Hamlet, it kind of registers as, oh, he's just got the line wrong, you know. And he's kind of making a point of the fact he says, doesn't he say what Hamlet says with irony, I say with...
Conviction.
Without conviction.
What, conviction. There you go. Yeah. So he's already sort of saying, I'm misappropriating this speech, but he's not only misappropriating, he's actually misspeaking it.
Okay, so he missed out the A, but kind of in context, because he's talking to Q, they're talking about humanity in general, so it makes sense for him to
exactly.
Leave out the A. Yeah. Okay, I get that now.
But since he gave Q such a hard time for changing the word world to galaxy, it seems that's kind of cheeky of him. Maybe he's testing him.
Possibly.
Maybe he's just checking that Q's actually, you know, memorised the whole of Shakespeare.
Imagine being able to do that. Because I'm reminded, like, if Q could do that, and then there's the point in, where is it? What episode was it? Data is dating Jenna DeSoro. Jenna DeSoro.
Oh, in theory. In theory.
In theory. And they're having that kiss. And Jenna immediately thinks, "So, what are you doing at the moment?" As well as kissing me, and one of the things was that, have I got confused again? I have, haven't I? Yeah, never mind. I've got confused again. It wasn't Shakespeare; it was Dickens. He was analysing the complete works of Dickens. So, like, if Q knew the complete works of Shakespeare, and Data could learn and analyse. On a whim, the complete work of Dickens, and like Picard can barely memorize a soliloquy, and I can barely hold a thought together or string two words together. There are lots, like throughout TNG, they're just the use of Shakespeare is really obvious. It's used in other, and they use it in Star Trek VI. With Henry V, once more into the breach. It's an episode of a Deep Space Nine. It's the name of a Deep Space Nine episode. We see Data rehearsing Henry V, and he said, I think that's in Emergence, and in The Defector, he's saying...
In The Defector, isn't it?
He's...
Because The Defector has that scene where Patrick Stewart plays two roles in one scene, doesn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, that's from Henry V.
Brummy accent.
Yes.
Yeah.
But in Emergence, he's saying that he's using Henry V as a way to understand humanity better.
No.
Ah, okay.
No.
Not The Tempest.
No.
Or is it the other way around?
Isn't it The Tempest? I haven't seen that episode for ages. I'm pretty sure it's The Tempest because Emergence is the kind of seventh season episode of Next Gen, and The Tempest is Shakespeare's final play. So I think there was kind of a thing there of
oh, okay. Possibly.
So in The Defector,
kind of getting ready to say goodbye.
Okay. Hold on. Because there's two things going on here. So The Defector is where Data is performing Henry V in order to understand humanity. And Patrick Stewart plays one of them in heavy makeup. But that's what he's doing. In Emergence, I had a question. And this is one of the things that I wish my knowledge of Shakespeare was better. Because Emergence... Data is performing the final scenes from The Tempest as Prospero. And the Tempest is, I guess, and I just found this in my research, that Shakespeare's own farewell to the theater, and Emergence being one of the last episodes of the series, and that they said that Emergence sort of follows the Tempest. And I would like to know more. I mean, I don't know anything about the Tempest. And so I want to see those, you know, the story of the Tempest and how it's being told in Star Trek.
Well, you know, I mean, Tony and I, way back in the kind of early episodes of Primitive Culture, we did, I think, a two-part episode on Shakespeare and Star Trek. And Shakespeare has always been a huge influence on Star Trek, you know, going back to the original series, something like The Conscience of the King being the most obvious example.
Right.
But you know, Shakespeare kind of crops up one way or another in Star Trek all the way through through to Deep Space Nine, the episode, which you mentioned, Once More Onto the Breach, not only has a Shakespearean title, but has kind of Shakespearean couplets written into the dialogue. I mean, it's very much, and the character of Kor in DS9 is modelled on Falstaff in the Henry IV plays. So Shakespeare's always been a big sort of underlying influence, I suppose, on Star Trek in particular episodes. I mean, I can't remember whether Tony and I even particularly looked at that episode, Emergence. It does have a reference to the Tempest. It does have this sense, yeah, I mean, because Prospero at the end of the Tempest is seen as a kind of stand-in for Shakespeare. Because he gives up his magical power. He says, this rough magic I here abjure. He's sort of letting go of this kind of magical creative power, in a sense, and drowning, throwing into the sea his book of spells. And so there is definitely a sense of this is Shakespeare kind of laying down his art, in a sense. And the next gen writers were kind of playing with something along those lines. I mean, I guess in terms of the episode itself, I kind of have to go back and watch it, and I haven't seen it. It's not one of my favourites. I haven't seen it for a few years. But I suppose there is the sense of, you know, Prospero is kind of commanding these spirits, Ariel and the other spirits of the island. And there's maybe a sense that, you know, there's this idea of the kind of the ship becoming conscious and this kind of emergent entity that's coming out of it. There's maybe something there about these kind of spirits that are longing to be free. You know, Ariel is longing for his freedom and wanting to kind of be let go. And in a sense, maybe the ship is, you know, birthing this kind of,
see, this is why we have
has to be let go.
Duncan.
But that's off the cuff. I'd have to go.
Yes,
go
this
and watch
is
the episode
why
more carefully
we invite smarter people than us onto Earl Grey. That's yeah, that totally makes sense.
Oh, so, wait till we talk about science or maths. Then Duncan will be like,
Then I'll be lost. Look, I couldn't do square miles. So yeah.
Between the three of us, we've got all our bases covered. So that's cool.
Yes. Mm. So another one
we could
I really like.
University challenge.
Yeah, another one that I really liked was from Menage a Trois, and I think it's one of the more, you know, memed ones. This is where Picard is, you know, talking to the Ferengi. And so I looked it up, and his little speech, he says, "My love is a fever, longing still for that which longer nurses the disease. In faith, I do not love thee with mine eyes, for they in thee 1,000 errors see. But 'tis my heart that loves what they despise, who in despite of view are pleased to dote. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day?" And continue. So that is a string of quotes from Shakespeare's sonnet number 18, number 141, number 147, and Othello. So I just thought I would mention that here.
And the great thing about that scene, and you're right, it has become this kind of this meme, which apparently is referred to as the angry Picard meme, which is weird because he doesn't look angry to me.
No.
He's not angry in the episode. But that's how apparently what that meme has come to represent for many people. What I love about that is Patrick Stewart doing bad Shakespearean. You know, Patrick Stewart, one of the greatest Shakespearean actors alive. I mean, I've seen him in The Tempest, actually. I saw him playing Prospero in The Tempest. He was wonderful. I mean, he's a, you know, brilliant Shakespearean actor. And if anyone's interested in the kind of work he was doing before Next Gen, go and find. There's a series, which I don't know, it probably is available on DVD. I mean, I think I watched it on old VHS tapes years ago. But there was a series that the RSC made in the 1970s called, I think it was called Playing Shakespeare. But anyway, it was like sort of 6 or 7 episodes. And they basically just took the current sort of company of the RSC, and they did this series of workshops and filmed them going through, I don't know, you know, character one week and verse speaking the next and so on. And they are just, A, they're very interesting. If you're interested in learning about Shakespeare, you learn a lot from them. B, just the people that are involved. You know, you've just got this stellar cast of, I mean, Patrick Stewart is the least of them. You've got Ian McKellen, you've got Judi Dench, you've got David Suchet, who, you know, went on to play Poirot and various other things, all just giving these amazing performances of, you know, individual monologues or scenes or whatever in this kind of workshop environment. And so you get a real insight, I think, into who Patrick Stewart was as an actor before Star Trek, in a sense, and to kind of his approach to Shakespeare versus some of these other actors. I mean, you know, Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen, as much as now we think of them as kind of best buddies, they're very, very different. Their kind of approach to the same material, very, very different styles, very different kind of, you know, personalities and so on. So I'd absolutely, you know, definitely recommend that. But aside from anything else, it will just give you a sense of what a brilliant Shakespearean actor Patrick Stewart is. And then to go and watch that Next Gen episode where the joke is basically, because the joke is always that Picard is a terrible performer. There's that episode where Beverly is going to offer him a part in the play, and he says, oh no, I'm not much of an actor. And it turns out she only wants him to play the butler, who has like two lines or something. So that's kind of the joke, is that I suppose they, you know, they knew. I mean, for my money, Patrick Stewart is by miles the best actor that Star Trek has ever, certainly the best, like, lead actor, the best, you know, main cast member that they've ever hired one way or another. Not to say anything against any of the others particularly, but it, just in a different league as far as I'm concerned. And yet we have this kind of running joke about how Picard is a terrible actor and, like, you know, yes, he's brilliant at so many things and he's this Renaissance man, he knows everything and he's this wonderful, noble character. But the one thing he can't do to save his life is perform. Unlike, say, Janeway, who, you know, we see in, say, when she has to be Queen Arachnia, kind of goes to that like a duck to water. Picard, it's always a bit bad. Even if you think of, like, even Dixon Hill, Picard is bad at Dixon Hill. He's bad at Shakespeare. He's bad at, you know, any of these things that he gets forced to do. He's just very uncomfortable with it one way or another.
But he's playing a wooden character really well, isn't he?
Exactly.
I think in that, what he's... serenading Roxana, he is playing, Picard is playing me, playing Picard, playing Shakespeare. That's how bad it is, yeah. That is not the only time that we see the sonnets being used in Menage a Trois. We also see it in The Schizoid Man, what he says to Dr. Ira Graves, so long as men can breathe or can eyes can see, so long light lives this, and this gives life to thee, from Sonnet 18. And also in The Measure of a Man, Bruce Maddox says to Data, when in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast state, from Sonnet 29. So yeah, just so much Shakespeare.
Yeah, there is. And what I found interesting was that, you know, Maddox finds this book, you know, in Data's quarters, and that book was given to Data from Picard. And so we have reference of that in Measure of a Man. And then we also have reference in The Most Toys when they all think that Data, you know, died, but he was captured. And Picard reads from Data's Shakespeare book, and it's a piece from Hamlet, when he says, he was a man, take him for all in all, I shall not look upon his like again. And so I like that, you know, sort of continuation of, you know, this book that Picard gave Data throughout the series.
I think there's an interesting point as well. I mean, that Star Trek has always used Shakespeare one way or another. I mean, Star Trek's writers have always been inspired by Shakespeare. But I think what Next Gen does more than any other Star Trek series, certainly, is kind of brings Shakespeare not just into the scripts but onto the ship, in a sense. So it's not just that the writing is alluding to it, or, you know, say Nicholas Meyer in Star Trek VI. Well, he, I suppose he brings it into the ship as well, insofar as he brings it into the dinner table scene and the Klingons, particularly General Chang is obsessed with Shakespeare and quoting Shakespeare in this kind of quite irritating way, frankly, you know, just constantly kind of dropping lines in here and there. But I guess what Next Gen does is it kind of brings the plays and a kind of literary appreciation of the plays into the lives of the characters, and particularly Picard and Data. And I suppose with a lot of these kind of cultural things, whether it's, you know, the classical music, whether it's the art, whatever it is, they're often ways for Picard to act as a kind of cultural mentor to Data. So there is this link between this sort of high culture and this kind of, you know, sort of liberal artsy education, and this idea of Data becoming more human. And the way he's going to become more human is, you know, I mean, admittedly, later on, he's getting involved in, you know, Gilbert and Sullivan and so on, slightly more kind of popular forms of entertainment. And he's, you know, also doing Sherlock Holmes with Geordie and so on. So he has a kind of widespread. But I think as far as Picard is concerned, it's about sort of giving him the sort of highest level of culture in some ways. You know, he's going to school him in Shakespeare because he's sort of an expert in Shakespeare. I don't know who it is who's teaching him, you know, the violin or whatever, but that's another element of it, is that he's going to, you know, kind of take up these, you know, sort of cultural pursuits and learn something. And there's that great episode as well with the life drawing class. I mean, that's the other, no other Star Trek series can you imagine there being a life drawing class, you know, with a nude model sitting there and everyone very seriously, you know, trying to paint this woman's picture and so on. And there's that wonderful scene where basically Picard is doing his best to do his painting. And again, I suppose, just as he's not much of an actor, actually, as much as he's very cultured and very kind of passionate about the arts, he's pretty crap at painting as well. And Data essentially rips apart his painting and says, yeah, you know, well, do you want me to be honest? Because this is not very good. And I suppose there's that kind of, that's almost a joke. I feel like that joke is kind of picked up in Voyager as well. Janeway, I think there's an episode where she's trying to paint and not being very good at it. But just the very fact that there is a life drawing class in the Enterprise, I think gives you an idea of the kind of institution it is. It is almost like a kind of sort of rather almost slightly snooty highbrow art center in space, you know, where you've got the kind of classical concert one week, you've got this the life drawing class in another room, you've got Shakespeare on the holiday. Everyone seems to be up to very sort of lofty pursuits. It's not Quark's bar where everyone is off, you know, kind of sex and sword fights going on in the holodeck, in the holosuites, as far as we can see. This is somewhere where the kind of cultural pursuits are aiming for a certain kind of level of respectability and sort of seriousness somehow. It's not just about entertainment. It's not just, I mean, even compared to other Star Trek series, you know, on Enterprise, we see the film night, for example, which is really just about kind of popcorn and fun. As much as they might be what we would kind of consider classic movies, they're often slightly kind of cheesy classic movies one way or another. You know, on Voyager, for example, we've got a kind of mixture because we've got something like Tom Paris, where it's all about kind of entertainment, slightly schlocky entertainment again, you know, whether that's Captain Proton, whether that's the 3D cinema that he sets up in the holodeck. It's all kind of lowbrow culture. And then, of course, you do have the highbrow culture via the Doctor, who's singing opera and so on. But it's seen as ridiculous. It's seen as pompous. It's seen as kind of an indication of the Doctor's sort of superior snobbish personality. So in a sense, as much as there is that kind of high culture on Voyager, it's put within a box of ridicule one way or another. Whereas on the Next Generation, I can't imagine that, you know, that wouldn't happen. It wouldn't be, you know, no one would kind of ridicule Picard for his love of Shakespeare. That's kind of absolutely integral to his kind of positive qualities as a captain. Whereas for the Doctor, it's sort of a sign of his ego and his kind of slightly absurd, sort of overreaching in a sense. There's kind of a sense of the Doctor, it's slightly uncomfortable narrative in some ways, that while with Data, you know, Data's very kind of humble, Data's kind of absorbing all of this stuff, but it's very kind of, you know, asking a lot of questions and very, very much sort of the student role. The Doctor is very much like positions himself as the expert on everything, because he's very kind of arrogant and so on. And with him, this kind of high culture is almost sort of associated with, you know, the irritating snob somehow.
Well, let's move into, you'd mentioned like the visual arts with the life drawing, and we obviously know and associate Data with his oil paintings and his charcoals, you know, when he was exploring his dreams in Birthright, or when he was painting in 11001001. You know, we just really do associate, you know, and he gives Worf a painting for his birthday. And, you know, he's, again, just exploring this humanity through this high culture, through the paintings and the drawings. It was interesting also to find in the research that Data tends to be very ambidextrous, except when he is painting and he's using his left hand. And that's because Brent Spiner is left-handed.
Is there not a point where he's using two hands to paint two different pictures
Yes.
at one time?
Yeah, that's in Birthright. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Now, I'm pretty sure Brent Spiner can't do that.
Probably not, no.
That would be impressive.
I know less about art, as in like drawing and painting, than I do about Shakespeare. So when it comes to that kind of those aspects, I'm completely lost.
So another visual arts that I thought of and that I think is used quite a bit is pottery, where we have Troy is instructing the class where Alexander, this is an imaginary friend, and, you know, she's like telling them that, you know, you want to make your clay take shape, focus on the feelings that you want, and then that's when Data builds the mask, you know, and sculpts this, and then it, you know, launches. But she's also in there when Alexander is making a cup for his father, an imaginary friend. And then also pottery is used as the winner of Captain Picard Day in the Pegasus, when the winner child makes a sculpture of Picard out of pottery. So we see this, you know, idea of using pottery and this art to express oneself. Again, just a very high culture thing and learning about humanity that way.
Have they maybe just looked at taking a typical kind of local community art center / town hall and looked at the what's on for a couple of months and said, okay, we've got this giant spaceship with over 1,000 people on it, a lot of families, they're going to need stuff to do. And let's just transplant that from our little town hall in the middle of Sussex to the Enterprise D, so that people can go and go on the holodeck and have kind of lowbrow, watch a movie, eat popcorn, or they can go and kind of read Shakespeare and learn violin or whatever. I think they've just given themselves a hugely wide range of things to do. So they keep them entertained on these huge missions that last forever.
I think that's absolutely a big part of it. And, you know, a lot of it is about kind of what do you do with your free time. And it's about kind of getting to know these characters through their hobbies one way or another. But I think Amy was sort of hitting on something as well when she said it's about self-expression. I think there's an element with some of those stories. It's almost like art therapy, actually. I mean, when you talk about Troy encouraging people to pursue art as a way of kind of sort of learning something about themselves. And actually, again, in Voyager, there's that episode where Janeway gives Harry Kim some time off, and she says she wants him to kind of reflect on what he's experienced and so on. And one of the things she says is paint a painting, I think. You know, kind of this idea, and certainly for Data, there's this idea that, you know, through painting, he's somehow going to get in touch with something about himself that he's not fully connected to. So there is that kind of idea that through art, you know, even if you're not a great artist, that through kind of amateur involvement in art, somehow you can learn things about yourself as an individual. And again, through acting and performance and theatre, I mean, that's the reason Picard is encouraging Shakespeare. That's the reason Picard is encouraging Data to pursue Shakespeare, is partly to learn about Shakespeare, but he could just sit there in the ready room and read it to him. But he's encouraging him to actually perform these roles as a way of trying to understand other people, in a sense, and to understand the human condition. And I suppose that's one of the things that I think you could say is a real link between Star Trek and Shakespeare, is that Star Trek, as much as it's all science fiction, it's about space and it's you know, set in the future and all this stuff, really it does come back to, on a kind of weekly basis, it's sort of interrogating what it means to be human. It's kind of looking at, you know, these sort of questions of sort of human identity and morality and all these kind of things, but never more so than in Next Gen, to be honest. And Shakespeare, arguably, you know, compared to the other dramatists of his day, is the one who, again, has this sort of unmatched insight into humanity in all its kind of varieties, in all the kind of depth of human psychology. I mean, as much as he's not a kind of realistic writer that we might think of, you know, from later eras, he is one of the reason that his plays are so popular and have survived for so many centuries, is that kind of perceptive insight into human psychology that he brings to these stories that are, you know, none of Shakespeare's stories are original. They're all stories that people have heard 100 times, you know, whether they're true stories or kind of, you know, basically sort of fictional stories. But what he brings to them is two things, I'd say. You know, one is the kind of very artful poetry and sometimes prose, but you know, really memorable, brilliant writing. But the other is just this kind of human insight and this kind of interest in people and the kind of reality of people. And I suppose in some ways you could say Star Trek and Shakespeare both sort of sharing that. They're ostensibly, I mean, if Shakespeare writes a history play, it's ostensibly about kind of, you know, big battles and this kind of, there's this sort of big storyline in a sense, but there's also this kind of really intense, detailed human interest. Star Trek, again, ostensibly is this story about spaceships out in space and, you know, stuff going on in the future and warp drive and transporters and all this kind of thing. But again, really, when it comes down to it, it's interested in something more human and more kind of real.
Well, one thing that you said that made me think of Data and his violin and sort of moving to the performing arts that we see, like when Data was playing the violin and it was like he was saying, oh, who was it? Pulaski? Oh, I really can't remember. But and he was doing a mixture of different composers, you know, in trying to play what he thought was perfect and, you know, trying to interpret it. But he can't interpret it because he's an android. So he took this mashup of composers to play that violin piece. But, you know, so it was sort of him expressing. And I sort of think that is Data's way of expressing himself, because he specifically chose the styles of artists who played the violin. And so to mimic them, that was his expression of who he was. Do you remember
that? Scene almost plays out twice from my memory, because I'm pretty sure almost the same conversation takes place in The Defector. And then
yeah,
again,
it might be that one, yeah.
Is it the Ensigns of Command where we first see him playing? I think that might be where we first see him playing the violin in Ten Forward. And he has this line to, because Beverly and Picard have gone to see it, and he basically says, oh, yeah, I wouldn't bother watching this. You know, you want to watch the guy tonight, because the guy tonight's going to give a real performance, and I'm just, you know, an android, and I'm just kind of mimic it. Whatever. And they have this conversation there, so it's Beverly saying, you know, don't sell yourself short, Data. You know, you need to believe in yourself, kind of thing. But I'm pretty sure that in The Defector, and again, I haven't seen it for a little while, that they're sort of having a conversation, and Data is saying there, or certainly in one of these episodes where he's performing Shakespeare, he's kind of saying, oh, I borrowed a bit from Olivier, a bit from Branagh, a bit from, you know, all these kind of Shakespearean actors, basically. And Picard, I think, is the one sort of saying, we need to find, you need to find your way of playing this character, in a sense, not just copying bits and pieces from the others. And I suppose that has something to say about how do we read these kind of classical texts? How do we relate to something like Shakespeare? You know, that ultimately it's about finding a connection between yourself and that story or that work of art or whatever, about finding a way that it sort of speaks to you. And it's interesting. I mean, the big the episode that was really at the kind of forefront of my mind when I, you know, suggested this topic was Darmok, which is my favorite episode of Next Gen. I think sort of the quintessential Next Gen episode, because no other Star Trek series, I think, in a way could have pulled that episode off. And no other captain other than Picard, I think, could have pulled that situation off. And it's partly because he's so well read and he's so kind of sort of classically educated and so on, that he can kind of paraphrase the Epic of Gilgamesh, you know, at a moment's notice, essentially. Even though, again, in that episode, he says, oh, I'm not much of a storyteller. You don't want me to tell you the story. And then he actually, you know, in this instance, does a pretty good job of it. But it's also just this sense that the story connects so directly to his situation. So it sort of underscores this idea that these ancient texts, you know, the Epic of Gilgamesh is not something that many people have gone and read. I've only gone and read it because on Primitive Culture we did an episode precisely about that, and I thought, gosh, I have to go and read this thing. And I was slightly dreading it, I have to say. I thought, oh, this is going to be boring, this ancient text, you know, it's going to be hard going. Actually, it's fantastic. Really, not just sort of beautiful, but very kind of earthy and sort of knotty and weird and kind of kinky, strange poem, basically. Well worth, you know, giving a bit of time to. But of course, what's interesting with these kind of things is that sometimes we think, oh, that's, you know, some big leather-bound book on a shelf or something. That's kind of got nothing to do with me and my life. And I suppose really with these great timeless works of literature, that what makes them timeless is that you can pull them down in, you know, 2019 or 2379 or, you know, whatever it is, and they will have something that speaks to you. And in that episode, Darmok, of course, it's very directly relevant to Picard's situation, because he finds himself, you know, the reason he's telling the story is he's basically saying, look, you know, this is a story about these ancient people in the time, you know, before, you know, this is sort of before biblical times, essentially. This is kind of really ancient human story. And look, here are we in this situation, which has a lot in common with it, let alone Darmok and Jalard, whenever, you know, whatever time period they were existing in, who, again, we're kind of relating ourselves to. So that sort of sense that, you know, our stories and our culture is something that we carry with us, and that we kind of almost can live out, again, that we can, our own lives can kind of connect to it, that it can mean something to us, that it can kind of inform our understanding of ourselves and of our, you know, situation and whatever journey we're on, and all these kind of things. I feel like that episode really stakes a claim to, it sort of exemplifies a lot of what's the most wonderful things about Next Gen. On the one hand, it has this quite sort of science fiction concept, this alien language that no one can translate, no one can understand. And on the other hand, very characteristically for Next Gen, the solution to that is in, you know, sort of go back to the classics, get those books off the shelf, sit there reading them, and you know, you'll work it out. Which is why I suppose it's Picard who's able to do it. And Riker, I was just watching that episode again today. It's a fantastic episode for Picard. It's a terrible episode for Riker. Riker is hopeless in Darmok. He's, you know, he's the one actually in charge of the Enterprise. Pretty much every decision he makes is a terrible decision. He doesn't really know what he's doing. He just kind of, he admits he's getting angry by it. He like just can't stand these people who are talking. He's basically, and he's like, you know, the typical kind of person who goes on holiday to another country where they don't speak the language and just starts, you know, shouting at the people speaking a different language, hoping that somehow they're going to understand him. And it's actually, frankly, Riker's fault. I mean, not that he could have known, really, but the whole reason that Captain Dathon dies is because Riker pulls Picard out just when they were starting to team up and do what Captain Dathon wanted. So I think Riker has a lot to answer for in some ways in that episode. But it's absolutely, you know, it's Picard's episode and it's kind of Next Gen's episode, because all those values are so kind of closely entwined. And really, it's the one, for me anyway, that hits all of those notes so perfectly and that really stakes a claim. If you wanted to say to someone, what is Next Gen about? To me, that's the episode you show them, because it's kind of all there on a plate.
No, you're definitely right there. It's not about all the fancy technology that they have, because that couldn't help them in the end. It was about this requirement for communication and the relationships and what it is to communicate with somebody. And that's what great storytelling is about. It's about communicating these human stories. And I think that's what Star Trek does in abundance. See, while we mentioned a lot about Shakespeare, yeah, but when I was doing research, there's so much of other great literature that's just used throughout all of Next Generation. We mentioned earlier that Dickens been used in Tapestry. I think Tapestry is Picard's version of The Christmas Carol. And I don't think I'd ever seen that before until I was doing this research. And now it just seems really obvious. And then, obviously, Data was playing Ebenezer Scrooge, which is interesting because when he's doing that in Devil's Due, he's been critiqued by Picard, who is a terrible performer. Picard, not Patrick Stewart, which was interesting. But in addition to those, like the greats of Dickens and Shakespeare, we've got Arthur Conan Doyle and all the Sherlock Holmes stories. We've got Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain's, Mark Twain's real name in Time's Arrow. We've got Raymond Chandler, whose popular detective novels were used in The Big Goodbye. And in the 50s and 60s, he wrote two books called The Big Sleep and The Long Goodbye. And so I think for the episode name, they've mashed them up to be The Big Goodbye. We've got Moby Dick, obviously, by Melville in First Contact. At the end of that...
Which, again, Picard misquotes.
Oh, does he?
Despite,
he's a terrible.
Despite, I mean, I know.
Do you know
it's
what?
Shocking.
In his defense, we did have World War III in between, which obviously corrupted all our data storage and maybe damaged.
Maybe that's the answer.
Of his great works.
Maybe that's what's going on. Maybe because it's hard to believe that. The fact is, Picard can pull out a quote from Moby Dick, off the top of his head in a given situation, which is pretty impressive, and yet get it just sort of slightly wrong. So it's this kind of weird sense of but he gives these sort of paraphrases very confidently, very convincingly. So maybe you're right. Maybe it's not. I mean, I was saying, maybe Star Trek's in a parallel universe where all these things were written slightly differently. But maybe you're right. Maybe the texts that have come down have got kind of corrupted. Just as, as I say, with Shakespeare, we had these bad quartos where, often in that instance, the sort of famous bad quarto of Hamlet, it's kind of fairly obvious where it's come from, because the character, the ghost, Hamlet's father, is the only one whose lines are actually correct. And everyone else's lines are a kind of really rough paraphrase of what they might be saying. So the scenes are kind of there in the right shape, and people say, broadly speaking, the right things. And there are odd lines that are the same as in the other versions. But a lot of it is just, so to be or not to be, it goes something like, to be or not to be. Yes, that's the point. Ah, tis a good one. Tis tough, that. Do you know what I mean? It's like, and it's very much clearly one of the actor who was playing the ghost obviously learnt his lines and could remember them. And everyone else, he was sort of vaguely aware of what was going on and tried to write it down afterwards. And he just obviously wasn't really paying attention, So, but who knows? Maybe as you say, the version of these texts that's gone forward into the future is a slightly different one way or another. Or another interpretation, the Star Trek writers either are a bit sloppy sometimes when they're kind of cutting and pasting, or for sort of creative reasons often decide, well, we'll just sort of slightly tweak this line here because it's not, we've pinched this from this literary classic or that literary classic, and it doesn't quite sound exactly how we want it in the scene. So we'll just kind of sort of massage it a little bit to give the impression we want.
They've taken a bit of an artistic license to it and made it exactly what they needed. An interesting point about the portrayal of these works, and like if you take a screenplay or a play or a work of Shakespeare, it doesn't tell you how to perform these things. And the same goes for a lot of the classical music. And I suppose you could argue that there's a lot more instruction in music in terms of all the ornamentation and all the dynamic marks and when to play it quiet and loud. It kind of tells you what to do in a lot of classical music, but still a lot of it's up to interpretation. Look at, there's some original manuscripts by people like Bach and Beethoven where they were, you might have been like in your 80s still writing music, half dead, but you had these ideas that had to come out, and you'd have your old quill and you'd be dripping ink over there and you'd be scrolling this music down. So like 300-400 years later, when they come to kind of computerize your music and publish it for like me to buy and play, there's a lot of translation that has to be done. There's a lot of guesswork. Oh, did Bach mean to make this a B flat, or is it a flat sign, or is it a natural sign? There's a lot of interpretation with certainly classical music, but also more so with kind of anything that you have to perform, like any text that you have to perform. How does it make you feel? And I suppose your performance is going to be all down to your previous experience on Earth. What does that tell you about what the character's feeling? And obviously in context with the story so far, I suppose.
And I think that question of what does it make you feel, again, is sort of a key part of it. Is this kind of, what's your response to it, whether as a participant or as a member of the audience? I mean, the episode that kind of came to mind for me, thinking of the kind of classical music on the Enterprise D, is Sarek, where, really what that scene is about is the fact that the music affects Sarek emotionally, and he shouldn't be responding emotionally to music because he's a Vulcan. And it's this real kind of moment of drama around the fact that, he cries a tear listening to this sort of beautiful emotional music, essentially. And interestingly, again, in Next Gen, completely... seems completely appropriate that there'd be this classical music recital going on in 10 forward, and that's what the ambassador would be invited to, and so on. It makes perfect sense. When Voyager replays the same scene again, and you have this kind of sort of fantasy scenario where it's Tuvok who is responding emotionally to the doctor performing opera. It's a joke. You know, it's the kind of doctor's silly fantasy. It's one of his daydreams. I think it's in that episode where he's daydreaming the whole time. And it's played for laughs. So again, sort of by the time you get to Voyager, this sort of high culture of Next Gen has become something to be sort of satirized. It's become something that can't be taken seriously. Whereas, you know, within Next Gen itself, it's absolutely sort of played straight down the line. There's no irony about it. There is no sense of, you know, I suppose what you see in First Contact, you know, where in First Contact you have Lily as the voice, basically, you know, she says directly calling bullshit on Picard's kind of lofty, you know, we're better than we used to be. We're these kind of evolved human beings. You know, he talks about how they've given up on money and how they've sort of bettered themselves and so on. This kind of real Star Trek ideal, certainly Next Gen ideal, the kind of ideals that Roddenberry, I think, conceived the next generation with, of these kind of sort of perfected humans, even compared to the original series. And I suppose in First Contact, you have Lily kind of puncturing that bubble one way or another. Again, in Voyager, where you kind of have these sort of callbacks or references to these things from Next Gen, you have that kind of sense of this being a sort of highbrow pomposity that has to be punctured. I mean, in DS9, you just have a very, again, a kind of very different approach. I mean, I always find it strange going back to those early Next Gen episodes, and we see O'Brien playing the cello in the Ensigns of Command, and it just seems so out of character for the O'Brien that we know. You know, in Next Gen you have O'Brien drinking synthol and playing the cello. In Deep Space Nine you have O'Brien, you know, downing ales and playing darts, basically, and that's kind of the O'Brien that we sort of come to know and come to love. But I'd forgotten this. I actually had to look into it. There is actually a line in one of the early Deep Space Nine episodes that references the fact that he used to play the cello. And it's the one where he's explaining to Jake, he's been sort of mentoring Jake to try and get him to up to speed so he can apply for Starfleet. And it's the point really where he realizes that Jake doesn't want to apply for Starfleet. And he says, well, you know, the funny thing is my dad wanted me to be a concert cellist and was sort of hothousing me. And I was, you know, I was this really great cellist when I was a teenager or whatever. And he wanted to send me off to some, you know, musical academy. And I was the one who said, no, I'm not doing that. And I went off and, you know, signed up for Starfleet instead. So there's that sort of sense of, even within the writing of Deep Space Nine, they've taken this detail about this character, the fact that we saw him playing the cello once. And they sort of said, yeah, someone else made me do that. I didn't really want to. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I don't know what, you know, why is he still playing on the Enterprise? Obviously, maybe someone noticed he had this background and twisted his arm and, you know, Riker or Picard or someone said, ah, you know, Mr. O'Brien, I see your, you know, grade 8 cello. We need you for this string quartet. And, you know, what's he going to do? He's going to have to say yes, isn't he? But it's interesting that Deep Space Nine specifically brings back the idea of Miles as a cellist in order to say he didn't want to do it. That wasn't him. That was kind of this sort of, again, not exactly this kind of pretension, but this, that was someone of an older generation's idea of what the right thing to do was, that this kind of classical music career was something that he should be aspiring to. And he actually wanted to, you know, fix computers for a living, basically. You know, he would have gone off and, I don't know, worked for Microsoft or something. He wouldn't have done this kind of classical, sort of old-fashioned career, in a sense.
Really interesting. All of those details have never occurred to me before. And I was thinking earlier today, the inclusion of all this, let's call it high culture, was it for, I'm making assumptions, was it for an American audience that might not have experienced this kind of thing before? Like Shakespeare and classical music? Was it to bring something a bit of depth to what was a mainstream sci-fi series? Like Star Trek was always cowboys in space, essentially. But then we're making it a bit deeper. And then with Deep Space Nine and Voyager, yeah, we've done it. We don't have to do it again. Maybe. I'm not sure. Amy, I can't really comment on what an American audience would have thought at the time, because I'm not American.
Well, listening to, you know, Duncan really making the comparisons through the series, it just sort of came to mind that it does really fit in with Next Gen perfectly, because when you look at the original series, like, they are exploring, and so that's their main goal. And where with Next Gen, it's like, yeah, we've been exploring for 300 years, and so we have overcome what is this hope and this idea that we are going to, you know, shove off money. We're not going to have disease. We don't, you know, what is it that we're going to do? So the answer is we are going to do high culture, and we're going to see it in the hobbies and how they interpret themselves and how they explore humanity is through this high culture. And I think it was Next Gen's answer. And so we get to see so many examples, you know, like with Picard and his Resican flute, like when in Fistful of Data's, the loudspeakers going, it's like, what's going on? And it was Picard making this composition of Mozart, including the Resican flute. And so this is what you did in your spare time to answer the question, what do you do? Like we are bettering ourselves. And then when we get to Deep Space Nine, well, there's a war going on. So there's not that much time to better yourselves in that aspect because we're fighting a war. And with Voyager, they're trying to get home. So there's not that much time. So I think in Next Gen, it does fit in so nicely. It is taken seriously because we are answering that question, how are we bettering ourselves? And the way that it seems to be is through high culture.
Well, I think it also ties into this kind of utopianism of Next Gen. I mean, Next Gen is the most, I mean, people say Star Trek is utopian, and I would broadly agree with that. But Next Gen is absolutely the most utopian. And it is, you're right, it exists in a kind of sort of geopolitical galaxy in which things feel fairly stable. You know, it's not so much about exploring the unknown and the kind of the dangers of the unknown, in a sense. It's not, you know, you're right. Voyager is about, both Voyager and Deep Space Nine are kind of under threat one way or another, in a sense. You know, Deep Space Nine, because there's this threat of this war, Voyager, because they're in this hostile environment and they're trying to get away from it, essentially. Both those series, in some ways, are about people being somewhere that they don't really want to be. In Next Gen, everyone is exactly where they wanted to be. It's this, you know, they've got the best job on the best ship. And a lot of it is, you know, ferrying diplomats around, all the sort of things that people say about Next Gen. But I think there is this sense that it's this kind of stable utopia. And I suppose maybe what the pushback from some of those other series is representing is a kind of sense that maybe the Next Gen position is kind of complacent, that there's a slightly, whether it's that we see it as ridiculous or that we just see it as not very human. I mean, in the same way as, you know, what Deep Space Nine kind of says is, well, yeah, you say you've got rid of money, but we haven't really got rid of money. You say you've got rid of religion, we haven't really got rid of religion. You know, all these things are actually still kind of in play, all these kind of less utopian, less sort of perfected to some extent, arguably, certainly from a kind of Roddenberry perspective, you know, things like money and religion. So they're all kind of connected. They're all these things that are things that, as he would say, sort of belong in the past for humanity, that we ought to be able to move, we ought to be kind of be able to rise above them. And in Next Gen, it sort of seems like we have risen above all those things. And then the other series keep kind of pulling us back down slightly, or kind of grounding us slightly. And I think it's not so much that they're too busy for these kind of high cultural pursuits, because there's a lot of leisure time actually on both DS9 and Voyager. And I'd say Voyager does sort of have a mix, as I'd say, but my feeling is if you sort of said, what do people do in their time off in Voyager? Okay, they go to that French bar, they shoot some pool, they play Captain Proton on a holiday. They do quite kind of lowbrow, not that going to a French bar is particularly lowbrow, but you know, it's just entertainment. It's about having fun. It's about kind of kicking back. It's about kind of enjoying yourself. Again, on Deep Space Nine, what do they do in the holosuites? Well, okay, a lot of people go to the holosuites for reasons that we probably can't talk about on a family-friendly podcast. Quite explicitly in Deep Space Nine, they talk about that in a way that they don't really... they allude to very kind of coyly in Next Gen. But they also go to kind of play James Bond fantasies. They go to play out war fantasies. They go out to play, you know, more like kind of video games in a sense, these kind of things. They're not going there typically for lofty cultural pursuits. The kind of lofty cultural pursuits, now and then the Bajorans come up with some sort of festival or something that involves a recital, and it always seems slightly dull and kind of, you know, it almost doesn't fit somehow with the mood of the show and the mood of the station. So I think there's just this kind of sense that, as in the way that those later series were slightly, as much as they respected that they'd kind of come out of Next Gen, they were sort of slightly pushing back against it. And I think this is one of the areas where, yes, they're still going to borrow from Shakespeare. Yes, they're still going to kind of invoke this kind of human culture now and then. And we do have, I mean, on Primitive Culture, our latest episode that just dropped was about Dante in Voyager. Two episodes of Voyager have Janeway reading Dante and talking about Dante. So, you know, it's not like the kind of highbrow stuff has gone out the window altogether. But I think there's more of an emphasis on the kind of schlocky entertainment, on the kind of on entertainment as opposed to sort of edifying culture somehow, and possibly that's a little bit more realistic for a group of people in a kind of quasi military environment who need something to, you know, kick back after their shift's ended and try to relax and kind of, you know, get through to the end of the day.
It could be the case that the Voyager and Deep Space Nine crew were a lot of times a bit younger, so maybe less likely to access Shakespeare and classical music. Like, I suppose a lot of the young people I know would never listen to classical music. So most of the people that I know that listen to classical music are a lot older. So the people that are going to listen to classical music on The Next Generation are Picard, obviously, because he's older, and Data, because he's trying to learn from the best of humanity. And the best that humanity has to offer are all our amazing composers that have lived throughout history, and Shakespeare and all the amazing literary works that we have available.
Well, you do get that dynamic, I guess, with Riker as well, because you get that set up with Picard and Riker where Riker never knows what Picard's up to. I mean, you get it in Darmok. He comes in and he sees the text of Gilgamesh on Picard's sofa or whatever, and he says, oh, what is that, Greek or something? And he says, no, it's, you know, it's the Epic of Gilgamesh. You get it again in First Contact, where he comes in, where Picard's playing that music. And
Bizet?
And I can Berlioz. You know, exactly, yeah. So again, there's that kind of sense. It reminds me very much of, I don't know if you've ever watched Inspector Morse. It's basically the Morse-Lewis dynamic in Inspector Morse. Inspector Morse is always listening to classical music, and Sergeant Lewis has no idea about any of it and is just, you know, he's kind of an ordinary guy. Basically, he's the kind of Miles O'Brien, in a sense, to Inspector Morse, is the kind of Captain Picard. And there is an age dynamic there, you're right. And maybe that is part of it. And even in Next Gen, I mean, Riker, as I say, not that interested in these kind of high cultural pursuits, much more interested in jazz, much more interested in kind of sort of more modern stuff one way or another. The other character, I don't feel Troy really expresses all that much interest, and maybe that's because we sort of see her as Betazoid and therefore kind of alien. It's kind of foreign to that culture one way or another. I mean, Beverly obviously is very into theatre, but she's into it from a kind of Amdram perspective, if you know what I mean. So she's doing Cyrano de Bergerac, or she's doing whatever, you know, but she's also doing that play that Riker is in, where in Frame of Mind, is not,
was it
exactly, you know, Frame of Mind, yeah, is, you know, he's certainly not doing Shakespeare, is he? He's doing some kind of what feels quite sort of modern psychological thriller type thing. So there's a kind of, maybe it is really, it's Picard as much as it's Next Gen. But I think the thing is, Picard is so central to the sort of ethos of Next Gen, more so in some ways than, certainly than Sisko is on Deep Space Nine. I mean, Sisko sets a lot of the tone of Deep Space Nine, and obviously, you know, he's a very key character in terms of the overall storyline and the arc and everything, and, you know, not least all the kind of mystical religious stuff and so on. But I suppose there's a sense that Deep Space Nine as a kind of community doesn't revolve around Sisko and his values particularly, necessarily, to the extent that even there's that episode where they all go to the holodeck to Vix, and Sisko's like, yeah, I'm not doing that. And it's a kind of tension back and forth as to, you know, why is it that Sisko doesn't want to get involved in what his crew are doing? And it's very much, it's not Picard not joining in the poker game because he wants to remain aloof. It's Sisko saying, actually, I've got a problem with this and I don't want to support it. And in the end, they kind of twist his arm and talk him into it. But I think it just sort of goes to show that the kind of, the sort of the entertainment, the kind of cultural pursuit there. And maybe actually, maybe it is a little bit like the poker game. I mean, maybe that's an element of it. Maybe Picard didn't go to the poker game because he's a snob and he thinks poker is for, you know, kind of, is sort of a waste of time. And it's also, again, kind of linked to the capitalism that they have notionally got rid of, because it's all about money and about gambling. And in some ways, poker in Star Trek makes no sense because no one's really winning or losing anything. At least in Voyager, they were gambling rations and they had limited supply, so they were no longer in this kind of post-scarcity situation. They actually meant something. So who knows, maybe there is that element to that. Maybe it's not just that he's remaining aloof, maybe he's kind of snobbish about poker playing one way or another. But he does say that he played in his youth, so, you know, who knows, maybe it's not that. But I think with Sisko, it's definitely, it's not, I don't think Sisko's interests set the tone for the whole show in that way. It's, you know, individual people are interested in they have their own hobbies and they're interested in their own things. Sisko's interested in his things. Dax is interested in her things. You know, Worf has his Klingon operas and his own sort of Klingon things. Yeah, everyone's kind of got their own stuff that they're into. And it's more kind of individual.
So I really have to mention that, and yes, there's lots of literature in Star Trek, but in terms of classical music, because I'm a classically trained musician, there was a total of 28 times classical music was used in Next Generation.
Does that... I thought you were going to say in Star Trek, because I was going to ask if that includes the Beastie Boys or not.
No. No. we don't do those movies. This is a Next Generation podcast. How dare you?
I know.
So we've had, just to name the composers that we've heard in Next Generation, we've heard Bach, Beethoven, Berlioz, Brahms, Chopin, Dvorak, Halvorsen, Handel, Haydn, Mompou, Mozart, Puccini, Reicha, Satie, Sousa, Tárrega, and Verdi. So it's just like, when I was researching, there's just so much classical music. And by far my favourite is the inclusion of Chopin's trio for violin, cello, and piano from the episode Lessons, which Nella Darin plays with Data on the violin. It's just an amazing piece of music.
And there is that sense, absolutely, in the episode Lessons of, you know, music as this thing that brings these characters together, you know, that the kind of romance of it, the kind of that's what they have in common, and it, you know, they're doing their kind of two-person recital, essentially, you know, Picard with his flute and her with her little roll-out piano and so on. I suppose you do kind of get, again, with Voyager in the episode Counterpoint, you get this sense of, I mean, that's an episode that really leans on classical music and you know, and the kind of you know, the formal elements of it, this kind of, the fact the episode is called Counterpoint, and they kind of talk about it, and that again, there's this sense of the sort of culture, that's what links Janeway to this very ambivalent, ambiguous character. You know, is he a villain? Is he a hero? You know, what is he? Is this kind of interest in classical music, one way or another? They sort of share this passion, and there's this sort of... But again, you could say there's this sort of question mark around it, because do we trust this guy? Does the fact that he seems very cultured and very sort of sophisticated... does that mean he's a good person? Because he's not Captain Picard. Do you know what I mean? It's not a guarantee of anything in Voyager. If anything, it's kind of, it ties into, I mean, that episode, which has this whole kind of shadow of Anne Frank and the Nazis and so on, is much more this sense of, you know, of exactly the kind of Nazi stereotype of the kind of evil person who's, you know, playing beautiful classical music and then murdering people at the same time, you know, which we see with the Cardassians in DS9 as well. Again, it's kind of sense that... you know, and the Cardassians are kind of cultural snobs to some extent, you know, talking about their literary epics and their, you know, all these kind of things. There's no guarantee that these things necessarily make people more refined or more sort of decent human beings one way or another. It may be that the person who's, you know, playing Captain Proton or whatever it is actually a better guy, ultimately.
Well, that was a really interesting discussion, and I'm going to have to possibly have a lie down in a dark room. Maybe just watch Star Trek instead. Have a glass of wine. Chill out a bit. There's lots of food for thought there. Amy, do you want to give me your final thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely wonderful discussion. Duncan, thank you so much for coming on. I loved how listening to you compare through the series, because I was just so focused on Next Gen. But to compare and contrast and see how high culture is interpreted and used in the other series was absolutely mind-opening. And just to compare and contrast, I loved it. I loved looking at the different types of culture, high culture that was used. You know, obviously Shakespeare and other works of art. You know, we didn't talk that much about Gilgamesh. And I remember hearing and reading about when Darmok came on air, that the libraries in the U.S. where everyone went to go and request Gilgamesh. And so there was this huge waiting list for the story of Gilgamesh. And I thought that was funny. But yeah, and also the visual arts and all of the paintings and just the music and the string quartets and just how it is infused in Next Gen and how it is used and how we get to see our characters use the high culture and these arts to their advantage and how it builds the character, and specifically like how we learn about humanity through these cultural events and how we see Q try to use it and how we see Data learning about humanity, I just think really helps us to learn about our humanity and what is it who we are, and is that who we can become through learning about the classics, I just think is really great.
Duncan, your final thoughts?
I guess one thing that just strikes me that we haven't talked about notably is the next gen movies. And I think there's a reason for that, which is that as much as they are on one level a kind of continuation of the next gen series, they are very different, and they maybe do have more in common with the Star Trek that was being made around the same time. So those kind of later seasons of DS9, Voyager, etc., Enterprise even, you know, kind of going forward. And so maybe there's an element of this that is not just about that particular series, but that is set in a particular kind of bubble in the sort of late 80s, early 90s. And even by the mid 90s, something has shifted, something has kind of changed one way or another. So in the next gen movies, you know, we don't see Picard, the man of culture and of Shakespeare and Dickens and everything, you know, in the classical concerts. We see Picard, you know, with a gun. We see the Dixon Hill version of Picard. We see Picard with, you know, with his guns out, literally kind of in both senses. I mean, there's this sense of this character is kind of being reframed as much more of a sort of traditional action hero in some ways. And so a lot of that sort of cultural stuff goes by the wayside. I mean, maybe that's also because of the kind of need for the kind of narrative needs of a movie. I mean, a lot of this stuff sort of fills into the category of what people talk of as pillar filler. You know, one of the things that was so great about Next Gen was this sense of the crew kind of in the off hours, the sort of almost inconsequential scenes, the sort of background stuff, the B stories, all this kind of stuff that really the original series didn't have in the same way. And I think the later series developed in quite different directions one way or another. With Next Gen, that was a real key part of, I suppose, Michael Piller's kind of vision for how to make that show work, you know, from the third season onwards. And it's definitely kind of characteristic of those sort of filler scenes, of that kind of background, the background storylines, in a sense, that are not the kind of main story of the week, that is often where these kind of cultural pursuits fit in. You know, even in a lot of those episodes, it's in the teaser, you know, so something like The Defector, the Henry V scene is in the teaser, and that sort of sets up the story or the kind of theme or one of the major themes of the entire episode. In a sense, there's that kind of, that link is there, and by putting it that way, it's almost sort of putting it in a box. It's like a kind of a little sort of introduction or a kind of prologue or something, making this link to the past, making this link to kind of classical human culture. And then there's sort of the Star Trek episode that kind of spins off from that one way or another. But certainly it seems to me that by the time you get to the movies, either there just isn't time for that anymore, or it's kind of, it feels a bit passé by that point. It feels a bit sort of, you know, that almost it's Next Gen has dated itself almost even within a matter of years somehow. That's something that we did on the TV series, but that's not really appropriate to bring forward to the big screen.
That's interesting. I think with movies, there's definitely less narrative space in order to include all these kind of high culture points that we've become used to. However, to give them their due, we did see Bach in Insurrection and Beethoven. We saw Berlioz in First Contact, Moby Dick in First Contact also, Haydn's String Quartet No. 5 was in Insurrection as well, Mompou's Canzio e Danza was in Nemesis. So they still found wee points to kind of keep it in there, obviously because they knew like 30 years later we'd be talking about it on a podcast.
Well, you're right. I mean, certainly First Contact of all the films is the one where it feels like it's the most tied in somehow, and particularly that Moby Dick scene.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
It's absolutely integral. I mean, it's the key scene in the whole film, in a sense. So you see, yeah, that absolutely is there. But again, there's that kind of sense that in that scene, Picard has forgotten the lesson from that book, and it takes Lily, who's not even read the book, to come in and say, you know, call him Captain Ahab, call him out to his face. And then it reminds him. And when he has that scene where he, you know, misquotes that line from Moby Dick, it's this kind of real moment of realization and reconnecting to something for him. And it's interesting, that is a kind of, that's the moment, I suppose, when movie Picard remembers TV Picard, is when he begins reciting this literature, in a sense, you know. And he kind of suddenly, having been very angry and kind of aggressive, goes quite sort of quiet and introspective as he recites this line. And from then on, there's this sense of that's the kind of moment almost of self-realization. I mean, you know, Amy was saying earlier that this exposure to these classics is about sort of finding out who you are and so on. And for Picard, it's really about reminding himself who he is and what his values are. And that is done through this link to this great work of literature. That's what kind of brings him back to himself when he's in danger of losing himself.
Well, I think we get this going back to the classics, even in Generations, like when they're giving Worf his promotion, like they go back to, you know, ancient times of sailing on the, you know, the ocean, right? And giving him his promotion that way. So it's like, it seems like TNG is always looking back to these classics, to this time, a simpler time, and you know, sort of extrapolating and bringing it to, okay, what can we do? So I sort of see that connection of, you know, linking to the classics, even in their giving of promotions.
I think this may be the Earl Grey episode where I've learned the most, possibly.
Well, that's because you always are teaching us the science, so.
You know the science already, yeah.
it's down to the fact that this is the episode I've known least about, with maybe the exception of the classical music. So, Duncan, thank you so much for coming on today and teaching us so much. It was really interesting. And as I always say on Earl Grey, it makes me watch Star Trek in a different light, because you research it, you watch it, then you research it, and it changes your perception of it. And then you come on and talk about it, and you get to other people's opinions about it, so it changes your perception again. And it just nourishes you and enriches the experience, I think. So thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Well, that is absolutely that's what fascinates me about, I mean, that's why, you know, primitive culture exists. That's basically why I enjoy doing that show. To be honest, it's as much the research as the podcasting. The thing I love about that show, because I write history books as my day job, and I will spend, you know, a year, 2 years sometimes researching one particular topic in enormous detail. And you get to know everything there is to know about that particular thing, and then you write the book and then you move on to the next thing. But it's a lot of work each time. I just love being able to, it's not just the Star Trek. I mean, I love going and watching Star Trek and talking about it, but I love learning about, you know, as I said, going and reading the Epic of Gilgamesh. I would probably, have gone to my grave without having done that. I didn't go out and rent it from the library the moment I watched that episode, unlike all those people in the United States. But I did, research for a podcast on it. I thought, well, I better go and read this book or this poem, and loved it. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, fascinates me about Star Trek is it is a franchise where the writers are very well read, are very kind of, whether that's in literature, history, etc., and are bringing a lot of stuff to the table as inspiration one way or another. And often it's stuff that we may not be particularly familiar with, and you can learn a lot, and it can benefit you a lot from going and engaging with those texts. And that music and those plays, etc., you know, in your own life. But it will also give you often an interesting perspective on the Star Trek episodes that you know, there are kind of links there. There are connections. There are kind of threads that you might not have been aware of if you don't go and read those materials.
I think that's what I love about sci-fi in general, really. It kind of draws on all this classical culture a lot to tell a story. Like, look at the planet of Vulcan, named after the Greek or Roman god Hephaestus, the god of volcanoes and fire and metal. And so Vulcan is a really hot planet. Sci-fi, generally speaking, has taught me a lot about kind of Greek mythology and Roman mythology. And it's why I went and read Stephen Fry's book, Mythos. It's why I bought an encyclopedia of mythology, and it's, yeah.
Well, that's a whole nother podcast.
It just explains a lot about what I'm interested in now. So, right. Duncan, tell me where people can contact you on the internet, please.
Well, you can find me podcasting on Primitive Culture on Trek FM, talking about a lot of the kind of same kind of things we've been talking about today, literary inspirations on Star Trek, history as well. We do a bit of film, some classic films, some more kind of schlocky films. So we sort of cover it all. You can find me on the Babel Conference if you want to talk about anything connected to one of those episodes or any other Star Trek episode or podcast that we've been covering on the network. And you can find me on Twitter at Barrett's Books. That's B-A-R-R-E-T-T.
I need to do a little thing, which is to... Amy, could you read this line for me, please?
I am the very model of a modern major general.
I have information, vegetable, animal, and mineral.
I know the kings of England, and I quote the fights historical.
From Marathon to Waterloo in order categorical.
I'm very well acquainted, too, with matters mathematical.
I understand equations both simple and quadratical.
About binomial theorem, I'm teeming with a lot of news.
With many cheerful facts about the square of the hypotenuse.
That'll do it. I will edit together. I will apply many layers of auto-tune.
Okay.
Give us some reverb on it. It will sound amazing. Thank you for that. Well, it's been so much fun talking about high culture and TNG, but that isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network. Here is what you might have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, continuing mission.
Why they killed that officer, what they have to do with Project Perseus.
Can I just throw my 2 cents worth in and say,
I
know who they are. They're Smurfs.
Oh, if only.
From the planet Smurfia. Tell me I'm right.
If you insist, sure, you're right. You're right. You're not, but I'll tell you.
Oh no, I've ruined it. I've ruined it for everybody.
So, yeah, that's the first mystery, and then a series of other mysteries happen as it becomes clear that it, on at least one other of the visionary class ships that have now they're now well on their way outside Federation space, that there was a saboteur.
Earl Grey.
But he also, you know, the first day of shooting, I shook his hand and I said, Mr. Nimoy, you seem to think I know what I'm doing here, but I like really don't. And he had said to me in the audition for the Vulcan Mystique, think 1,000 years of wisdom behind the eyes. And I thought, oh my goodness, that's a tall order.
Yeah, that's a lot to put in the eyes.
Literary Treks.
We're not messing around anymore. The reset button is gone. Characters' lives are going to move forward. Fortunes are going to change. When things happen, you can take it seriously. It's not all just going to get forgotten by the time the next book comes out next month. This is going to be something that is going to carry forward and is going to have lasting repercussions on all of the literary books, not just the ones written by Mac, not just the ones in this particular sub-series, but by joining them all together and having nods to the Star Trek Corps of Engineers, to Voyager, to DS9, to Enterprise.
Standard Orbit.
We've had some various folks and, you know, guest star roles and things that had passed here and there, you know, the last year or so. And all of that is sad, but when somebody who was really a part of the foundation of what Star Trek is and what it became, it really hits you kind of hard.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all of these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop Apple Podcasts app to get the latest episodes as soon as they are published. And please leave us a star rating and written review. That helps others to find the show, and we might read it on air.
If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, YouTube, and most third-party apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place to join in the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it will come right up.
If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and select Earl Grey. That will come right to us, and we might read your email on the show. You can also find the network on Twitter,
and Instagram at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. So, Amy, where can people contact you when you're not playing cello, singing opera, and doing foot pottery simultaneously?
Well, that's a lot of my time dedicated to doing that. But when I'm not doing that, you can find me over on United Federation of Podcasts, where I have started a new podcast called All Good Things. Yes. So that's going to be talking about all things Star Trek with my good friend, Patrick Devlin. So you can find me there. I am still in the Babel Conference, where I love being, and you can find me on Twitter at Miss Amy Nelson. So Joe, where can people find you when you are not listening to classical music?
Well, they can still find me, even though I might still be listening to classical music, on the Babel Conference. You can email me, joepodcasts@gmail.com, or you can get me on Twitter at joeyjoe77uk. If you'd like to help us keep all our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more. Available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We'd really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm.
Joe, bonus question?
Oh, please.
Alrighty. So out of all of the high culture arts, performing arts, visual arts, Shakespeare, what is one high culture thing that you would like to include in your life?
Well, darling, I'm already an actor and a musician, so perhaps something else like art, like painting. However, I have done some art classes recently in watercolour and acrylics, so yes, I don't know. I'm multi-talented, you see, so I really can do anything if I put my mind to it. If the notion takes me, you know?
Oh my gosh, that's great. Okay.
And you, Amy, please do it in a voice.
Oh, in my high culture voice?
Oh, yes.
Well, let's see. Don't tease me about my accents.
No, your accents are darling, divine.
My high culture that I would like to include is to go to the theater. I enjoy live theater so much, and I don't get the opportunity. Las Vegas could be a wee bit more cultured.
Indeed. All you can see is like Donnie and Marie and Michael Jackson in virtual reality, who's dead now.
Yes, and Thunder Down Under. That's not high culture.
Mm-hmm. And the Chippendales.
Yes.
Not very high on culture at all. Let's avoid that. Who would ever live in Las Vegas?
Oh, my dear.
Oh, dear. Disgusting. What came over us? What happened there, Amy?
Well, we are going to take this opportunity to recognize our current high-cultured associate producers. They are Norman Lau, Michael Huto, Thomas Appel, Chris Tribuzio, Jim McMahon, Joe Keegan, and Justin Oza. Thank you for supporting Trek FM, and especially Earl Grey.
I like how you said his name, Justin Oza. So join us next time for another cup of Earl Grey.
Great joy and gratitude.
This is to Amy. Oh, my love is like a red, red rose that's newly sprung in June. Oh, my love is like the melody that's sweetly played in tune. So fair art thou, my bonny lass, so deep in love am I, and I will love thee still, my dear, till all the seas gang dry.
Oh, that was so beautiful.